Welcome to Urban Dharma, the podcast, where suffering is optional. Hi, this is Reverend Kusala coming to you from downtown Los Angeles, from the International Buddhist Meditation Center in the heart of Koreatown. What you're about to hear is an interview I did at the second Monks in the West Conference, which took place in Collegeville, Minnesota, at St. John's Abbey. Reverend Hung Shir, the abbot of the Berkeley Buddhist Monastery, consented to do an interview with me. He's about to publish his first CD, Buddhist Folk Songs, that he wrote. And we covered a lot of territory in this interview. It's just about an hour long. So without further introduction, I'll let the interview unfold naturally for you. This is my interview with Reverend Hung Shir, the abbot of the Berkeley Buddhist Monastery. I'm speaking with Reverend Hung Shir tonight. We are in Minnesota, and we are participating in the second Monks in the West Conference. And I'm going to ask Reverend Hung Shir to just give a little introduction to the Monks in the West, because he was he helped organize the first and second, and it's something to hear. So, Reverend Hung Shir, thank you for consenting to speak with me and do this interview. And can you just give a little history on the background of Monks in the West?
Right. Several years ago, Buddhist and Catholic nuns came together down in Los Angeles and organized something called Nuns in the West. And we were in touch with the Buddhist nuns and were friends with the Catholic nuns and heard from both sides that it was just terrific, that the monastics from Christian Catholics and from Buddhists of all different descriptions have a lot to share, have a lot to talk about. And we have been doing other kinds, we meaning the Buddhist monastics in the West, Western Buddhist monastics from various traditions, have been meeting with Catholics in various formulations, but we'd never come together just as monks to talk about issues common to our respective traditions. And so we thought, what a good idea. We had been celebrating an event called the Chan Zen Catholic Conference in Northern California. And one of the monks who is leading, I guess he's chairperson of the Monastic Interreligious Dialogue, MID, a monk named Father William Skudlarik, was in California and came by City of 10,000 Buddhas, which is our big monastic complex up in Northern California in Ukiah. Paid a visit, met the abbot, Abbot Hung Lu, and I was there. I'd known Father William from various conferences before, and we said, well, why don't we do Monks in the West? So the idea was set, and we made a plan to do it in 2004 at the City of 10,000 Buddhas. And I guess we had about a dozen, six Buddhists, six Catholics who sat down together and spent 3 or 4 days talking it over, and went to visit, I guess it was 2 or 3 days, actually, hit upon a plan to talk about celibacy as our first topic, because this is central to the life of a monastic. So 2 years passed, and lots of plans were laid, and we've now met. This is last night before tomorrow's final gathering, and we've had a grand old conference, and we've spent 3 days here, most, at St. John's Abbey and St. John's University here in Collegeville, Minnesota. And it surpassed our hopes, I think, in terms of building a kind of basis of trust, a brotherhood, and getting right down to the issues. Because these are serious monastics. I think the eldest ordained monk is 50 years in robes, and he's 70 years old. And then we go on down, both on the Buddhist and Catholic side. So we have some serious years in precepts here, people who've been ordained for half a century, and not quite half a century, but quite a few on both sides. So it's been very rich, and I get the feeling that people are very happy with how it's gone and are ready to do it again.
And are there any of the conversations we've had in the conference that, that stand out in your mind? Something you were surprised to hear?
Well, just the topic itself is okay. Not what you call popular. Celibacy is viewed in some circles, I think uninformed circles, as being unhealthy,
yeah.
As being kind of the last choice, even if you're... even if you're dysfunctional, even if you're burned out by the standard description of love and romance, having a broken heart, some people think, is better than having no relationship at all.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a very secular worldly view. From the view of the celibate monastic, this is the high road to spiritual awakening. And it's also the road to compassion, where you are related to everyone in a very heartfelt way. So that's there's a standard view of celibacy that I think the monastics, East and West, Asian and Western, are familiar with. And this conference, has shown a light on that common misperception. And these are very healthy men who also choose to live alone. Monastery monastic has a root in monos, monokos, which is alone in Greek, meaning
so there's solitude. A sense of aloneness rather than loneliness.
That's right.
In the monastery.
And alone, of course, that's a kind of a pun, if you look at the word, all one.
Yeah.
Meaning a door to compassion, to true relationship, not an individual, selfish, personal relationship, but a universal compassion, a feeling of being one with. So anyway, hearing that was really discovering that across the board, Buddhist and Catholic alike, and intra-Buddhist as well. Mm-hmm. It was really gratifying. Another thing that caught my ear was having the abbot here of St. John's University speak very frankly about the Catholic pedophilia scandal that really hit the fan in 2002, and it continues to bleed right now.
Yeah.
And certainly it needed to be outed and to get put it break drag it out into the sunlight, and he did that fearlessly today. And very, I think, healing to have him be so frank, talking about the problem and the steps the Catholics are taking to set it straight.
Mm-hmm.
And when I heard that, I thought, Catholic monasticism has a future.
Yeah,
it's like a boil being lanced. You know, if you don't lance the boil, it's going to fester and fester and may take your limb.
Mm-hmm.
But he was willing to lance the boil, and this is an authority figure who has suffered, I'm sure, as many righteous, wholesome Catholics have done, by this problem. But the conversations that resulted in our circle from having brought that forward were very helpful in understanding my own spiritual path and the pitfalls and also the triumphs.
One of the things I really liked today was when you were speaking about the relationship between celibacy, samadhi, and prajna, that they are all connected.
Right.
And I think a lot of people who are practicing meditation and who may be listening to this podcast may not see the connection. Could you speak a bit about that?
Right. From the Buddhist perspective, celibacy, and that word probably needs some unpacking too. It's just to say a life where you as a monastic, male or female, promise to use your sexual energy in a different way. That is to say, you're not going to get married.
Mm-hmm.
You're also not going to behave in a sexual way. In other words, you keep your sexual energy and use it in a way that transforms. So this notion of sexuality, that you need to find a mate before you're healthy, is true if you're going to make a family. And using, and it's, if you're doing it that way, it's very easy to go wrong, you know, just testified to by all of the ways that we go wrong with sexuality in society, with divorces and with, you know, rape and with abuse and with broken hearts, et cetera, et cetera. So we're all clear on that. How easy it is to go wrong in a heterosexual, homosexual world. It's very difficult to get a satisfying relationship and make it work. Mm-hmm. So a monastic, it, being a celibate, is not for everyone. And people always come up with a criticism and say, you know, well, if everybody lived like you, you wouldn't be here. You know?
Exactly.
And so, yeah, great. I'm sure glad my parents did have me, and the family stuck together through hard times, and that really counted. But given a wholesome family life and a strong foundation, certain individuals are willing to walk the high road. In Asia, it's called a holy life, and say that, you know, if I use that energy in a different way, skillfully, I can actually transcend suffering. And this is actually, the Buddha embodied this in his person. This is the historical Buddha, the prince who left the palace. He was married. He could have been king of India. Instead, he chose to use his energy towards wisdom. So to answer your question, the idea is that the Buddha said, if you can not only not put your energy into a nuclear family, into a personal relationship, but instead turn that energy back, particularly avoiding five serious errors. And this is the skill, is in his pointing out, killing, stealing, lust, lies, and intoxicants are the ways we lose that energy most seriously. And also get in trouble with the law, with society. He said, but if we can, instead of killing, stealing, lusting, and that's where the celibacy issue comes in, lies and intoxicants, if we can take that energy and transform it, then our minds can become still and pure. Mm. And those are two values, two qualities undervalued by society. Where do you hear anybody singing the praises of stillness and purity?
Yeah.
And yet, stillness and purity in the mind is the very thing that you have to use, that I have to use, that everybody in the world has to use to solve our problems. We face our problems with a chaotic, turbid mind or with a still and pure mind. And when those problems rise, as they do normally in anybody's life, if we have still, quiet mind, i.e. samadhi, that's a word that means stillness and purity, concentration, then insight can be right there. And we know what to do to manage the least harm, the least harmful solution, and the most beneficial solution for everyone. So wisdom is that insight, and that's the result of stillness and purity.
And the insight would be a very important liberating factor,
that's,
according to Buddhism, or is it the liberating factor?
Well, it's the third step of the three, which then leads to compassion. So that would be a liberating factor from the point of view of my tradition called the Mahayana, which really values the Bodhisattva path, the path of the awakened being, and points us towards that and models that for us. So anyway, the idea is that another way to translate this, this series of steps is character, concentration, insight. So who you are as a person is the first step of the Buddhist path. And if you're a monastic and you say, no, I can avoid having to have a personal, special love of my life, and be patient with that pulling away from the cultural drift, for until samadhi results, until my mind is still and quiet, not turbid and chaotic as it's been and will continue to be at some points in my life, day to day, thought to thought sometimes. But I've had the flavor of samadhi that results from concentration, from meditation. And that oneness, that sense of wholeness and identity in myself that opens up into identity with others, is a flavor I never got from a personal romantic relationship that's high today, low tomorrow, misunderstood tomorrow, pissed off the next day, infatuated the next day, head over heels the next day, lonely adrift, bored, broken hearted the next day. That's a flavor of its own, and it makes great literature, it makes great theater, it makes great songs, But this is the Buddhist description of suffering.
Exactly.
And of ignorance, the source of ignorance, as a clinical description of ignorance. Uh-huh. So anyway, to have that sense of samadhi that can result, anybody can reach if they quiet their mind down and mm-hmm. follow those rules, then the insight that results is priceless.
Yeah.
And that's when, you know, you say, boy, that if you met somebody who has that insight and that wisdom, mm-hmm. you can change your life by 5 minutes conversation with somebody like that. Because yeah. why? They're grounded, mm-hmm. they're clear, mm-hmm. they see through the surface, mm-hmm. they understand stuff,
yeah.
they can look at a branch tip and tell you where the root was,
mm-hmm.
they can see the root and predict where the branch tips will go. Because
wow.
they see cause and effect.
Yeah.
And yet, nothing magic about them. It's just the mind sharpened by samadhi and calmed and quieted, purified by precepts, and then lit up by the light of wisdom. And that's the promise. That's the deal. But to get in the ballpark, you have to, what a friend of mine said, make a soul sacrifice. Which is to say, you say, yeah. no, I'm not going to, you know, look for the love of my life now. Maybe I've done that before. That's fine. This is my chance to follow the Asian tradition, say the Tao, mm. this path that opens into stillness and wisdom. And I'm going for it, you know.
Yeah.
So celibacy, this sounds like this word is so scary to so many people. Yeah. It's a question of how are you going to use your energy? What are you going to do with your time? You know how much time it takes to get a relationship on its feet and keep mm-hmm. it going?
And then to keep it going,
keep
too.
Keep it
yeah,
going
yeah.
so hard.
Yeah.
And even then, things come up. You know, she changes.
Yeah, and you change.
You change.
Yeah.
And so, or the culture, or neither one of you changes, but she dies. Or you know,
yeah.
et cetera, et cetera. All of those heartbreaks are built yeah. into the relationship. Okay, so that's fine. Nothing wrong with the relationships. One important part about this conference that I liked so much was nobody said women are bad.
Right.
Women are evil. Women are the problem. And women don't say, oh, you men are the problem.
Mm-hmm.
In the monastic world, it's that, no, women are necessary. I came from one. You know, I'm deeply related to women. But I also want to say thank you to the women who gave birth to me and nurtured me by aspiring to something higher.
Yeah.
Aspiring to something wiser and deeper that then can really help people, other people, get through their suffering and trouble.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the Buddha did, and I aspire to do that. I'm inspired by it and want to imitate it. So, your original question was, what's the relationship between precepts, samadhi, mm-hmm. and wisdom, between mm-hmm. character, concentration, and insight? And it's that samadhi, or the celibacy, is not something separate from that.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something that you take on because you know, you're some sort of a masochist or you're just uptight and repressed. No, in fact, it's necessary to get you in the door so that you can actually light up inside. And if you hold those precepts really well, don't harm people. You're not selfish with your desire,
that's
you
right.
know, encroaching on other people. But instead, you take that energy and skillfully use it in your meditation. Your mind gets quiet. Your sixth senses cool off.
Mm-hmm.
Things, you see the patterns. Things mm-hmm. show up. You understand.
Now, if I could just add something for clarity, that we're part of a monastic conference. We've been involved in it for the last couple of days. And so we're thinking like monastics.
Right.
And there will be a lot of people who listen to this podcast who aren't monastic, and they'll say, after just hearing what you said, does that mean that I can't become enlightened if I have a girlfriend? Or if I'm married. Now, what would you say to them about that?
I didn't say anything of the sort. What I said was, how do you use your time?
Exactly.
How do you use your energy?
Good.
Has nothing to do with a relationship.
Okay.
But if you want to, you know, if I was your girlfriend and you said, you know, well, I'm going to go cultivate the Buddha's path, I would say, I'm going to find another boyfriend. Why? Because if you're really going to do what the Buddha did, you got to do it full time.
Okay.
Okay, now, let me qualify that, too. You don't have to do it full-time. You can do it on the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? It's going to be frustrating. It's always going to be one step forward, one step back.
Okay.
One step forward, two steps back. Why?
Okay.
Because during the week, when you're not meditating, if you're very skillful, it makes no difference.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
But before you get to that place of skillfulness, you have to work at it. You have to work on your mind.
Mm-hmm.
Habits rule. So where do you use your eyes? Where do you use mm-hmm. your ears? Where do you use your heart? That's the issue.
So what I'm hearing and please correct me if I'm wrong, is what you're talking about is the most direct path to enlightenment. That if you decide to have a relationship and a child and all those things that most people have, that it's the potential for enlightenment is still there. We all have Buddha nature. But it may take a little longer, or it may take a couple more lifetimes because the effort's not being put in the same way as a monastic.
Well, I don't see other lifetimes. I'm just working with what I have in front of me. And
okay.
Again, I wouldn't say that either. I wouldn't quote what you said. I would say it's a question of how you use your energy.
Okay.
Where does your time go? You know, I look at myself. Where was my time before computers?
Mm.
You know, I had hours every day more available to me before I sat in front of a monitor and started reading my email and trashing my spam. You know?
Me too.
So there you go. Take that time away.
Okay.
And then relationships are hard to do in any case, in the mm-hmm. best of cases. Things are, you just don't really know what that person across from you is thinking.
Exactly.
You know, and she doesn't know what you're on your mind. And
yeah.
you have your secrets and you have, you know, and everybody's, mm-hmm. This is a hard time to do relationships.
Yeah.
Be they corporate, be they for business, be they partnerships, be they musical, you know, bands, your basketball buddies. It's hard to get it. It's hard to keep relationships together in this time.
Mm-hmm.
And so, if you're going to do a relationship, do it really well. Give it what it needs to make it work. Can you make relationships a spiritual practice? I think they're different things.
Okay.
Why? Because Buddhist meditation is going to be successful or obstructed based on how well you use your six senses.
Mm-hmm.
Where are your eyes going? Are you looking at the form of your beloved and the face? Well, that's terrific. That's the Song of Songs. It's in the Bible. But you won't be able to... If you can do that and then detach from that and not care particularly about that complexion and that eye color, and any complexion in the eye color is the same to you, well, maybe you can, in fact, use, you know, relationship as the path. But people attach. Mm-hmm. We love the things we love. We are averse to the things we hate.
Yeah.
You know,
that's right.
I know that. Yeah. And so that's right away, you know, somebody's going to please you, your mind is moved.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't use your eyes as skillfully as somebody who is not in that relationship but is using the same method.
Mm-hmm.
So I encourage lay people to cultivate. Cultivate something appropriate to a householder's life, to a relationship life. How do you use your energy?
Yeah.
You know, for a layperson to try to cultivate the way a monastic cultivates and then be frustrated when they don't get somewhere or demand that they be given the equal treatment is the equivalent of saying, well, I know third grade math. I want to be considered a nuclear physicist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're not there yet.
Yeah.
Why? You didn't do the work.
Yeah. But the potential to do the work.
Potential is always there.
Always there.
Sure.
Okay, yeah.
And class, as you suggested, does it take more lives? Classically, that's the way the sutras describe it.
Okay.
That the Buddha is said to have taken three great asankhya, countless eons, to become a Buddha.
Yeah.
So, you know, how much the more so us in the age of the internet and network TV.
That's the truth. Well, speaking about internet, network TV, and media, this is a very much a change in direction of our conversation. One of the things that excites me about your life, besides your practice, and is the fact that you've gone in a really interesting direction for a monastic, and that direction is you have found, and these are my words, you have found music useful in disseminating the Dharma,
mm-hmm.
and there seems to be something about music that doesn't need a translation that mm-hmm. anyone from any country can understand mm-hmm. good music, perhaps. I know we've talked before about this, and you mentioned when you moved into the monastery, you had a guitar, and you used to be in college. You actually were part of a group, and you would sing, and it was a great fun, and I'm sure fulfilling for you to do mm-hmm. that. But you decided to give that up when you went into the monastery,
right?
But now you've picked it up again.
Right.
And what I'd like to ask is, what was the turning point for you?
Okay. Good question. I was a folk singer back in the 60s, like many of my friends. I made a living that way for a while, put myself through school. And it was, as you say, very satisfying. I really enjoyed the process, and I sang with some terrific singers. And in the Detroit area, like South Central Michigan and Toledo, Ohio, and that area. There were lots of folk singers around, and we were just one of the many. But it was really fun, and I enjoyed it a lot. And so when I became a monk, I entered the monastery with my Guild guitar, my D40, bought from Manny's in New York City. And it was a wonderful guitar. And part of the Shramanera precepts, the novice precepts that one takes to be a monk, is that you promise not to sing, dance, play musical instruments, or watch or listen to entertaining diversions that way. And excuse me, the story goes that Master Shenhua, late Chan Master Shenhua, was my teacher in religion, was a very wise monk and a wonderful teacher of young men and women, including young Western men and women. And so I came into the monastery full of these ideas. I owned two Nikon cameras, a Volvo, and my Guild guitar. That was my last possessions. So I knew Buddhist monks had to give up their attachments, you know. So I had this headstrong idea, kind of like a martial marine coming in there. So I sold my Volvo at a huge discount loss and sold my Nikons got paying back student loans for way less than they were worth. And I put an ad in the San Francisco Chronicle to sell my Guild guitar at a ridiculously low price. And the ad appeared in the morning, and the phone rang in half an hour. And this guy says, "Guild guitar, $300, don't sell it, I'm coming over."
Wow.
So, you know, so he did. He showed up like 30 minutes later, doorbell rang. I'm here at Gold Mountain Monastery, in the Mission District in San Francisco. And as the doorbell rang, sure enough, it's this guy who's coming to buy the guitar. The telephone rings, and it's Master Shenhua calling from upstairs in the monastery.
Hmm.
He says, "Guojian, Shifu, what are you doing?" I said, "Shifu, I'm selling my guitar." "Why are you doing that, Guojian?" I said, "Shifu, it's an attachment. I got to get rid of my attachments." I said, I'm going to become a monk." "Stupid," says Master Shenhua. I said, "Shifu?" He says, "In America, this is not China." He says, "Americans understand music." He said, "A bhikshu who could play music would be very useful in the future. You could use this to teach people the Dharma." "But Shifu, it's an attachment. I got to get rid of it. I got to get rid of my guitar, Shifu. Otherwise, I can't leave home." "Stupid." Hangs the phone up. So I sold it, disobeying my teacher was telling me something, you know, and I followed my headstrong idea of what a monk's supposed to be like, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And as soon as I sold it, I regretted it. I knew right away that was a mistake, but I still went ahead and did it. So for 25 years, I didn't touch a guitar.
Wow.
I was learning Buddhist music, and Buddhist music has instruments, percussion instruments, wooden fish, the bell, the handbell, the drum, lots of instruments, you know, lots of percussion. And so I learned those techniques and enjoyed them. I probably went as deeply as any Westerner has ever gone into Chinese Buddhist liturgical music and developed a real liking for it. And I hope to preserve it as music comes to the West. So the story goes on that I was in the monastery in Berkeley where I live. We host other groups, and a teacher came and who's there every Thursday night and celebrated his 50th birthday. And he too had been a folk singer. He's the same age as I am. And they were celebrating his group was celebrating his birthday as a Buddhist teacher. And he pulled out his old guitar and sang a Crosby, Stills, and Nash song.
Wow.
And I thought, and this is a very kind of rambunctious group of Berkeley, mostly psychotherapists. And everybody's got opinions and talking, and you know, 50 people, 51 opinions, you know. And so as soon as he played the first couple notes of the song, everybody turned into one heart and one mouth, singing in unison, "Teach your children well." Crosby, Stills, and Nash.
Yeah.
And I thought, boy, that is a powerful, expedient means. And my conversation with the abbot came back at that point, and I thought, Let me get a guitar again. I want to write Buddhist music. And further, I want to bring over the Chinese liturgy that we're doing and translate it. Mm-hmm. And I want to preserve the glories of the Chinese Buddhist tradition. They're not going to survive in America. Americans want Western music, Western musical modes. So those three things: new Buddhist songs, translated liturgy, and preserve the Chinese liturgy just because it's so wonderful and it has more to give to us. So those are my three ideas. And in the process, I've written now 30, 40 songs.
Wow.
And put some on a CD for the very first time in July of this year.
And now that's one of the things, too, I find exciting. But when you put together your Buddhist songs, and just for people who play music, do you go and use old melodies, add new words? Do you create the melody in words yourself?
Both.
Both.
I really like to adapt roots, melodies, and modes.
Okay.
And because why? Everywhere Buddhism goes, it changes the new culture it meets and is changed by it both. Mm. Historically, from India to China, Korea, Japan, that's the northern tradition, Mahayana, from India to Sri Lanka, Thailand, Cambodia, Laos, Burma, that's the Theravada, the southern tradition, and then north, Nepal and Tibet. Those cultures have all been changed by Buddhism and have produced their own distinctive Buddhism. So it's not going to be any different in the West. And so we are, in the West, we swim in music. We are just surrounded by all these wonderful heritages. So I wanted, as if I'm going to be a kind of a catalyst, or you could say a bridge to bringing authentic Asian Buddhist music over to the West, I want to graft it onto the root traditions of Western music. And we're a young culture. We haven't been around 300 years. China's been around 5,000, for example. Yeah. India the same, longer. So in our 300-year history, we've had a rich influx of African-American music. We've had a rich influx of Celtic music from the British Isles. Mm-hmm. And we've also we've come to a Native American tradition that was here way before us, rooted in the soil and the wind and the water and the animals of North America, this continent. So I've studied African American music and what became, how it merged and became the blues, and Celtic music through Appalachia, old-time music, and also Native American music. So some of these tunes just emerge. I'll pick them out and put translated Chinese Buddhist lyrics or write new lyrics for them. And then later find out, oh, that was actually a blues riff that, you know, that was, I heard it from Kerner, Glover, and Ray, you know, or I heard this from, this is a Blind Lemon Jefferson song that Peter, Paul, and Mary picked up, you know, and I heard it early back. Or this is a Native American anthem that I learned from the singing of Joanne Shenandoah. And then found Guanyin Bodhisattva lyrics that matched it perfectly. Mm. Or sometimes they come out of the air. Okay. I love melody. Melody is magic. Yeah. And when you can land a melody, you feel like you've actually been a conduit for something that was waiting to take form.
Yeah. Now, I've been to your website. Could you share with everybody your blog if they'd like to come visit your website?
Right. There are two ways to get there. Okay. One way is to open your search engine. If it's Google or Yahoo, and type in Dharma Forest.
Dharma Forest.
D-H-A-R-M-A Forest. Okay. Two words. Type it in, and the blog will come up in the search engine. You click on it. The formal address, which is longer, is Paramita. Uh-huh. P-A-R-A-M-I-T-A. Paramita dot typepad. T-Y-P-E-P-A-D dot com. Okay. C-O-M. So paramita dot typepad dot com in the address line. Mm-hmm. That's HTTP, www, you know. Mm-hmm. And another way to go is to type Dharma Forest into your search engine.
Okay.
And that'll pop it up.
And the reason I bring that up is because you have some wonderful pictures about the process of making your first CD.
Right.
And I was wondering if you could talk about that, how the people came together. There was a wonderful picture of you practicing in the monastery.
Right.
It's sort of an overhead shot.
Right.
And you have all the instruments laid out. And
right.
What was that like? How did you pick the people? What tunes? I mean, you said you've written 35, 40. Which mm-hmm. ones seem to be the most important ones for your first CD?
Okay. Well, since I just gave you that address, let me give you one more.
Okay.
The CD is going to, you'll find news of it on the blog on Dharma Forest.
Okay.
And then the count, you have to scroll down to find that. But if you want to, for people to go directly to the website, that will have all the tracks on it and news of it and photos, go to dharmaradio.org. D-H-A-R-M-A radio. Dharmaradio, one word, .org.
Okay.
That's the URL, www.dharmaradio.org. D-H-A-R-M-A radio. And that's where the CD is going to be distributed from and hosted from.
Okay.
And so you can actually stream it at that point. It's not there yet. We're still doing some tweaking, but it's coming. And you'll find news of it there and updates, and then soon it'll be available. Okay, the issue is that I have a musical community in Berkeley that is very nurturing and very supportive. And one of the people who's central to it is a man named Josh Michael. Josh is teaching me banjo, clawhammer banjo. Josh knows roots music. He publishes Appleseed Records and really has an ear and knowledge of roots music. And he's in touch with many of America's finest roots musicians, Jody Stecker and Martin Simpson, who's not American, but Martin is in England, is the one of the finest purveyors of Celtic and Northern European folk traditions forward. And also Martin Carthy. I met all these people through Josh. And Josh has a good friend named Henry Kaiser. And Henry is a music producer and musician as well. He's an avant-garde guitarist. And Henry has produced something like 200 records and has played on 300 records. And he's seriously a musical genius. And Henry likes the music that I make. Josh introduced me to Henry, and I played my songs for both of them. And they said, well, let us volunteer to put you up, to get you going. And so we found Fantasy Studios in Berkeley. And and through Josh, which is, Fantasy is the home of, you know, Santana.
Yeah.
Creedence Clearwater Revival.
That has.
Yeah. And also, you know, Thelonious Monk, Miles Davis have all recorded, you know, there, Bill Evans and... So anyway, that's very high stratosphere, high altitude company. You know, I'm a folk singer from Ohio. You know, Buddhist monk plays guitar. But anyway, very generous people helped me out. And so we found musicians, including Alan Sinaki, who is one of the founding members of Bluegrass Intentions. He's the Zen master, head of practice at Berkeley Zendo. So here's another Berkeley Buddhist musician. Bluegrass musician, and Alan was very generous in offering his guitar and his voice and his mandolin playing. And it was a real thrill to get Paul Hostetter to come up from Santa Cruz. Paul is one of Northern California's premier music repairmen. He also builds violins, and he repairs and builds string instruments, and many people go to Paul first for their repairs. He's uncanny with his repairs. He used to also build Santa Cruz guitars. And Paul came and played 12-string guitar, mandolin, and guitar. And Paul's wife, Robin Petrie, played hammer dulcimer. The two of them, they're magic music. You know, Robin plays in the Bay Area and Celtic and Turkish santur, the, you know, wonderful hammer dulcimer. And Alan called and said, I have a friend whose name is Brian. He said, you got to get Brian to come over on fiddle. So Brian is a fiddle player for Dan Hicks and his Hot Licks.
I've heard of that.
Played for 14 years with them, and he's now taking care of his mom, who has Alzheimer's. And so Brian was very kind enough to come by and join in, sit in. So we just rehearsed one night at the monastery, and I had sung 30 songs for Henry Kaiser, who's the producer. Henry, by the way, produced all of the music for the movie Grizzly Man, that recent film with Richard Thompson.
Mm-hmm.
And Henry's the producer of that, all of the soundtrack of that film. So he at Fantasy. So he took me into Fantasy and said, this one, not that one. This one, not that one. I like that. What about that? Sing it again. Not that one. This one. So we sorted through these 30 songs and got down to about 18. Okay. And rehearsed them the night before. The fiddler came in and just did them on the spot, you know, and sat in. So we recorded in 2 days at Fantasy. Took about 12 hours, got 18 tracks. It went so smooth. Everybody was just in the mode and in the mind, and it was very harmonious and high. You know, everybody felt energized by the experience, and it was my first time in a studio at all. First time before a mic, but I was so happy and enjoyed it so much that there was no sense of nervousness or. Mm-hmm. Now listening, having recorded it in July and listening now, there's a lot that I would do differently. Uh-huh. But for a first experience, you know, I have few regrets. Now, there, since then, I've asked a couple musically skillful, some great ears to listen to my cuts, and they have heard two tracks that they have told me to redo. So I think we're going to tweak it again and hope to have it out by late November, December.
No, we were talking about that a couple of days ago, and right. To me this is a fascinating insight into music, right. As well as spiritual music or music of the Dharma. And could you go into just a little detail of what was wrong with those songs?
Two of the songs are, in fact, they were... some people pick them out as the strongest songs of the 18. By the way, the 18 got cut down to 15. We just decided the three of them were not strong, and so we 15 is a lot for a CD. So.
It is, yeah.
So of those 15, two songs that were picked out by other people who were doing the sequencing, including the engineer, who's a man named Stephen Hart, who is the chief engineer at Fantasy, and a wonderful musician, great ears. You know, he's the man at the board, and he's... brought so many artists into the world. You know, he's kind of the godmother of all this music, or the midwife. Anyway, Stephen and Henry picked out these two songs as the strongest. But as I listened to them, and then I had another monk listen, and he said, you know what? Those two songs are worldly good. For a monastic, there's a problem there.
Hmm.
And I listened again, and they were right. And I had a very talented musician, a woman, who knows, she's a concert pianist and really knows music. And she's also a Buddhist. And she listened, and she said, you know what? She said, guys won't hear this. Women are going to hear this, these two songs, and they're going to move their emotions. She said, you're singing... not like a spiritual father, but like a boyfriend.
Mm.
And I think I might have blushed, you know. And I thought, she's absolutely right. And Henry didn't hear that. And he was listening, because Henry doesn't think like a monastic. Mm-hmm. I think like a monastic. Mm-hmm. And he's counting on me to control my, you know, to produce the sound that I want.
Sure.
But I used to do Broadway musicals as well before I was a folk singer, during the time I was a folk singer. And so... here I am in front of the microphone, five musicians around me, the tape is rolling, I want to give it my best.
Right? Sure.
Well, the old habit, mm-hmm. stepped forward. And so I pinned my friend down, I said, well, what do you mean women will hear this? And she said, well, you're using diminuendo on these, you're hitting the note and then pulling off it. You're going like, look at where life leads, mm-hmm. like that. And she said, that's emotional. And it's a hook. Mm. It's a trick that does very well if you want to insinuate your way, if you want to seduce someone, you know. And I thought, she's absolutely right. And I was singing a blues.
Yeah.
It's a blues song. It's the only blues song on the album.
Yeah.
And I just kind of thought, I got to do it again or maybe pull that one off the record.
Mm.
Because if, as a monk, monks sing all day long. But there's a monk's way of singing that conveys purity. At the same time, it communicates the song.
Hmm.
If you're singing praises of the Buddha, you're not seducing. You're not seductive. You're not using diminuendo. And I was being really careful not to use vibrato because, you know, Frank Sinatra can use vibrato all over the place. And he's so good at it. Frank Sinatra's fantastic vocalist, able to sing, emphasize, hit the stress before the note or slightly after the note to convey the emotion of the song. And I was trying to strip all of that out of my voice as I sang so that the lyrics and the melody were there and it was strong, but it wasn't sexy in the least, because that, for me as a monk, especially a senior monk, that would be a defeat.
Yeah.
That would, no matter how good the song is, that would still, it would cheat the listener mm-hmm. into being just like any other song. Although it's got Dharma lyrics, yeah, but the message is, you know, this monk is moving into your heart, you know, in a way that's not going to get you to resolve on Bodhi, on awakening. It's going to make you like it so you'll attach to it. Mm. You know, which yeah. is cheating for a monk.
Yeah.
That's not pure, you know.
Yeah.
So singing straighter, that's not the word either. Not to take the musical values out of it, but to sing it from a pure heart is the goal.
Okay.
And when I heard those two songs from that criteria, I thought, oh my, I heard it immediately. Wrong. Got to do it again. The other song is actually a sutra. It's the song of the Buddha's, they call it the song of victory in the Theravada tradition. It's called Craving is the Builder of His House.
Mm.
And I like the melody. That's a case of a melody came out of space to match the translation. But the song has a range that's slightly out of my, it's not in my comfort range. So to hit the high notes, I had to punch it up. I didn't want to go flat.
Yeah.
And so I gave it more oomph, and you hear it.
Mm.
And it's, as a result, it's like I'm using a more masculine, gendered voice than I want.
Okay.
And I only heard it after listening with those ears. You know, I mean, there was something slightly off about it, because it sounds like a young Elvis Presley a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
Without, you know, not Jailhouse Rock, but
yeah.
It's got that quality, or rather, it's Righteous Brothers quality. That's closer to
one
it.
One of my favorite
oh,
groups.
Oh, me too.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
for a monk,
but for
you
a
know.
Monk, yeah.
You're my soul and my heart's inspiration. Can't do that as
it,
a monk.
It doesn't
you know?
Work. No.
And my song goes in that direction because it's got that quality. It's kind of a it's a gospel sounding, the Buddhist song of success. You know, craving is the builder of this house. Yeah. Oh, house builder, I see you at last. You'll build no house anymore.
Mm.
Your ridgepole shatters, your rafters all fall down. My mind realizes the unborn,
yeah.
and craving comes to an end.
Mm.
You know, it's easy to go, craving comes to an end. Wrong. Can't do it that way. You know, it's got to be more like, craving comes to an end, like that.
I can hear the difference.
It's a difference, and I'm not warm and it sounds funky, but yeah. in when I heard those tracks with that context, I thought, do them again.
Yeah.
I don't want to release an album that, you know, may go out to 1,000 listeners and have to think, gee, I really hope they don't hear it wrong, or I'd really wish I hadn't done that.
Yeah. You know?
So we're going to go back, do it again. It was the first experience, and kind of tweak it a bit. The other songs are okay. They're funky and down home, homemade, and kind of jug band, and but they're all from an innocent heart. So
good.
I want the Dharma to come across from an innocent heart. Then the music will, you know, it'll be there.
Now, have you decided whether you're going to sell this or give it away?
Here's what we're planning.
Okay.
I'm not going to make money. There's no way that, you know, what would I do if I made money?
Yeah.
So what we're going to do is say we want it to go virally, to, you know, spread like a virus. And we're going to use the internet, definitely. We will make a product. You'll have a CD in your hands and probably an environmentally friendly case, not a jewel case.
Mm.
But what we're going to say is we'll probably price it something like $10 or $12, or maybe not even that, and say, if you would like to own a copy of this CD for your very own, please do a good deed. Go out into your world and do something meritorious, wholesome, and then send us the story. Email in the story, what it was and what happened, and we'll send you the CD. And if you would like to donate for it, then 50% of the profits from your donation will go to the United Religions Initiative, to the URI, so that religions can, we can find peace among religions. Because the URI is an organization I work with that is determined to end religiously motivated violence.
Wonderful.
And to bring cultures of peace, justice, and healing to the earth and to all living beings. So, 50, and URI is struggling. You know, the interfaith is having a hard time during the Bush administration.
Yeah,
you know.
It is.
So, we'll, 50% will go there. And meanwhile, if people will send me stories of the deeds that they did, so it's good karma music. It's, you know, music for karma, wholesome deeds.
Yeah.
That's the idea. And the internet allows us to do that.
And what was your inspiration for that? Had you heard about somebody else doing that?
Yeah, actually, well, no, it was just a conversation with a friend of mine named Nipun Mehta, who is the guiding light behind Charity Focus, this social service organization inspired by Gandhi.
Oh, okay.
And the idea of, you know, give me money for this music. The music's not that great. It's the beginning of Dharma music, and it's rough and raw, you know, it's homemade. And the idea that I'm kind of embarrassed to ask people to pay for it, but I would not embarrassed at all to ask people to, if they're inspired by it, to go out and make the world a better place.
Yeah. What a wonderful idea. Wow. Well, you have a guitar here, and I know it's late. We're talking 10:15,
mm-hmm.
and for regular people, that's not too late, but we've been in conference all day long. Would you be willing to do something to give people a preview?
Oh, sure. I'd love to.
And
let me see here. How about something that you'll never hear anywhere else?
Okay.
Let's see here. Okay, we have, this is, there's a child ballad. Child was the collector of English ballads. That's a child, not children, child, but a collector, a musicologist named Child, who was a Henry Child, who collected many of the ancient ballads in England, Scotland, Wales, Ireland, and in the West. And among them was a song called A Cruel Mother.
Hmm.
And it's also called Down by the Greenwood Sidey. It has a bunch of names. It's floated around a long time. But it's got a remarkable melody that's got a haunting sound. And I, on this album, I have three songs that I consider not anti-war songs, but peace songs.
Okay.
Songs that make you think about the way we resolve conflict and make you think about why so much of our money goes into weapons.
Yeah.
That are geared entirely to ending human life. And that makes no sense to me. Mm-hmm. I come from a family of decorated war heroes and military men in my family. And I'm a monk and devoted to not even letting thoughts of anger rise or dwell in my mind. So I thought Dharma music can definitely talk about that, can talk about alternatives to warfare and to weapons. And so this song has an edge. It's called Death Parade.
Mm.
And it's melded into the Greenwood Society, the Cruel Mother song. It goes like this. Oh, and it also talks about the Pure Land as a chorus. There's a refrain here that goes, Namo Amitabha. Namo Amitabha. Amitabha is the Buddha of the Pure Land in Mahayana Buddhism.
Okay.
Namo Amitabha means I return to the Buddha of limitless light. And it's also used as a kind of an expletive. It's like Namo Amitabha, meaning, oh my goodness, you know, or what can you do? You know, it's like Namo Amitabha or saints be praised, kind of like this. So this is the background of this song called Death Parade.
Okay.
Had a dream the other night, Namo Amitabha. What I saw gave me a fright. Take me to the Pure Land. The kings of death were on parade, Namo Amitabha. Followed by the ghosts they made. take me to the pure land. Their bones were white as ocean gulls, Namu Amitabha. Their crowns were set on eyeless skulls, take me to the pure land. The king said, fight for God and land, Namu Amitabha. He put a weapon in my hand, take me to the pure land. We fought for God as we were told, Namu Amitabha. Useless, now my bones are cold, take me to the pure land. Mass destruction, be afraid, Namu Amitabha. Follow in the death parade, take me to the pure land. God said killing is a sin, Namu Amitabha. Men go wrong with religion, take me to the pure land.
Wow. What a great lyrics.
That's a little different, right?
It sure is.
Okay, let me do just one more.
Okay.
If you don't mind. Let's see here. Well, how about... here we go. This is a lullaby.
Oh, do you want me to hold that?
Yeah, do you mind?
Okay.
This song was stimulated by seeing... orphans in India. There were three of them, and they only had themselves. They were asleep. This was in a Buddhist holy site in India. And I saw the three of them just huddled together, sleeping, and was thinking, when they wake up, you know, they're still alone. When they go to sleep, they're still alone. And
yeah.
I couldn't help them. I couldn't support orphans, but I wanted to wish them companions. So that I thought, if only someone could say to them, you know, the sun is your companion, the moon will guide you home. You know, when you dream, you can ride your dreams and wonder, and when you come back, you know, the stars are there for you, and wishing them well on their journey. And that was all I could do, was give them a song.
Wow.
Father is compassion, Father is wisdom, Buddha is the child. Mother is matter, Father is energy, kindness is the child. When you close your eyes and slumber, hide your dreams and wonder, the stars in the sky will guide you home. When you wake up in the morning, the sun is your companion, all the world will greet you with a song. Mother is the ocean, Father is the island, waves on the beach are the child. Moon is the mother, sun is the father, light in the eye is the child. Be kind to tiny creatures, contemplate their sounds, love the smallest, and you live with love. When your eyes are open, may you meet with bodhisattvas. Everyone awakens before long. Mother is the paper, Father is the notes, song is the child. Mother is the valley, father is the mountain. Echoes are the child. Now you close your eyes and slumber. I look at you and wonder who you've been, who you will become. May your life bring people blessings. May your words dispel the darkness. May you shine like the morning sun.
Lyrics again. Wow.
Buddhist lullabies.
Yeah, it's wow, that's great. Well, you know, it's really getting late now, and I don't want to keep you up any longer because we still have one more day to go.
We do indeed.
In the conference. But I want to thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to sit down and talk with me. And I'm going to also put your web addresses connected to this interview. So people will be able to find you again.
Awesome.
So I guess until tomorrow morning, have a good sleep.
All right. Thanks for the opportunity.
Well, that's it. That was my interview with Reverend Hung Shir. Hope you found it interesting. Hope you found it useful. For more information on me, please visit my website, kusala.info. That's kusala.info. If you'd like to hear more of my podcast and see a couple of videos I have posted, please visit dharmatalks.info. That's dharmatalks.info. If you'd like to download some free ebooks on Buddhism, please visit buddhabooks.info. That's buddhabooks.info for free ebooks that you can download or read online. And last but not least, if you'd like to email me, I'll get back to you just as soon as I can. My email address is kusala@urbandharma.org. That's kusala@urbandharma.org. Well, thanks for listening, and until the next time, until the next podcast, be happy, be peaceful, and most of all, be free from suffering.